I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my day.
Joining me now is Patricia T. O'Connor, who, until her most recent book, relied on three little words for her titles. There was Woe Is I, now out, about to be released in a third edition, updated?
Yes, yes. And two new chapters, in fact.
And in a moment I'll ask you what those chapters cover. There's Woe Is I Junior for kids. There's You Send Me, Words Fail Me. And the most recent one, four little words, Origins of the Specious.
Yes.
And all covering different aspects of the language?
Yeah, more or less.
Are there that many things to say? Well, the English language has to be the most complicated language in the world.
Well, I can't say that. I can't, since I'm not familiar with Finnish or Turkish.
And you don't
or
know
lots
Kosa
of,
or any of those languages.
No. And the ones where you make the clicks, no. So I can't say that. But it's pretty complex, and I probably will never get to the bottom of all the books that I could do about it.
And what has what are the two new chapters in What Was I Dealing With?
Well, one is just spelling, and one is just pronunciation. That's partly because so many questions from WNYC listeners have to do with pronunciation. So it's a whole new chapter now with lots and lots of new words,
well,
including
always,
banal.
There are all of these variations in pronunciation.
Yes.
For example, the pun in your new book, Origins of the Specious, reminds me that there are people who say species and
mm-hmm.
people who say species.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who say sociology and people who say sociology.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go on and on and on.
Yes.
And I've always wondered which one, or economy and economic and economic theory.
Right. Right, right. But I think people think they need permission to adopt a pronunciation that's a little bit different from everyone else. And many times that pronunciation is perfectly legit. But they don't believe it until they see it in print.
Are the words species or species and specious related? Or is it just a coincidence that they are so similar?
I should know that, but I don't.
A listener asked, and I thought I would pass it on to you.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll have to find that out for next time. I should know that, but I don't. I would guess that they're somewhere at the bottom of it all, they're related.
Well, before we get to calls, you usually have a few things that you would like to share with us. A reminder that our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And what have you been thinking about over the past month?
Well, I don't know if you remember the last time I was on, at the very tail end, someone asked why a restaurant tab is called a check.
Mm-hmm.
Why would it have the same name as the kind of
Because you've
thing
been hungry.
Oh, you're balking again. Okay. No.
For the Romania of the show.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't want to rush it, Pat.
Are you quite finished? Okay, if you're...
Oh, we can sweeten the pot. No way you're going to get me to stop this.
Okay, you win. But anyway, I wanted to follow up with Czech because I got a lot of mail afterwards that said, oh, I wanted to hear more about this. But I did some checking, and it turns out to be very, very interesting. All the modern senses of the word Czech, including the bank draft, the restaurant tab, the move in chess, checkered tie, all these are ultimately derived from one word in Persian that I'm sure you know, Shah.
Mm.
Which means a king or a monarch. And Shah was also a term in chess, which was played in Persia many centuries before it was introduced into Europe. And a Persian chess player said Shah as a warning that an opponent's king was under attack, or Shahmat, to mean I've got you, which, of course, evolved later into checkmate. But that original Persian word, Shah, passed through Arabic and probably Old Spanish, Old French, and it finally ended up in English in the 1300s as the name of the game, chess, and our interjection or warning that we've cornered the other guy's king, check or checkmate. And originally, the game was played on a board that was called a checker. And since then...
And we play checkers on
exactly,
those kinds of boards.
That's
the same
why,
board, in fact.
That's why checkers is named checkers. It was played on a checker, which was originally the word for a chessboard. And that original word check has given us, umpteen meanings. The adjectives checked and checkered, that is marked with a chessboard pattern. The verb check in all its many senses, including to stop or block or to verify, even to check one's coat at a restaurant. And the bank check, which originally the check part of the bank draft was the little receipt stub that you kept as a reminder to check against your returned bank draft to verify it. And also eventually the restaurant tab. And in Britain, by the way, some forms of check began to be spelled with a Q-U-E instead of a K in the 17th and 18th centuries. And even the word exchequer, which is the royal treasury, was originally spelled with a K, and it's thought to get its name because when the king's accounts were toted up, they were toted up on a large table with a checkerboard drawn on it for different categories of things. And so that's how we got the word exchequer even. So
it's amazing how all of these different things can come out of the game of chess.
Yes, yes.
And I'm so bad at chess.
I am too.
Then again, I prefer somebody else pick up the check at the end of the meal.
Yeah.
Should we take some calls?
Yes.
Okay. Our number again is 212-433-9692. Ellen from Harlem, you're on the air.
Hi there. I always enjoy Patricia's time with you. Thank you. I have two questions. One is people, I think, misuse the word presently. And what do you think is a good option instead of that? And also, can we firmly debunk Mr. Mayor Bloomberg's use of anyways?
Yes, anyways is considered not a standard word, but it's very common. Also, anywheres, by the way.
Anywheres?
Anywheres. Not so much in this part of the country, but other parts of the country, you'll find anywheres and nowheres.
Oh, that's encouraging.
Right. And presently, I should say, has actually two meanings.
Wait, I want to go to the anyways.
Okay.
The mayor comes from Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be an explanation? Is it more likely used up there?
I don't know that.
A New Englandism?
I'm not sure it's a New Englandism. I heard it in the Midwest when I was a kid, so I think it's pretty widespread.
Okay.
But isn't it ugly?
There are so many ugly things in the world.
There are a lot uglier things.
But Patricia's in the business of protecting the language.
Well, not protecting so much as maybe illuminating it a little bit.
Well, let's get to presently and currently.
Okay, presently has two meanings. It can mean soon, mm-hmm. or it can mean now. And generally, the meaning now is not accepted by current usage people.
We would say at present.
We would say at present, right. Usually a as usage stands now, when we use the word presently, we generally mean soon.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So currently and presently mean two different things.
Yes.
Okay. We go now to Kenny from Clifton, New Jersey.
Hey,
hi, Kenny.
I wanted to address the word mature being pronounced mature.
Mm-hmm.
We don't say natur for nature. We don't say fixtur for fixture or futur for future.
Okay, so you're bothered by mature.
Yeah,
that's
mature.
That's a pretty common pronunciation.
Well, many people say mature.
And many other people say mature.
Sure, yeah. But I'm just saying,
right,
like, where
like
did
it Tuesday.
All say, oh, I'm gonna, you know, highbrow the word to mature.
Well,
because it almost begets it. You know, it almost like you're like a mature instead of we don't say fixture.
Well,
or net tour.
I hate to disappoint you, but it's among the standard pronunciations of the word.
Okay.
And there are even no usage notes here in the American Heritage Dictionary saying that there's any reason to avoid them. They have these pronunciations. Mature. Oh, they have the Y one first. Mature, mature, and mature. So all three of them are acceptable. So I guess maybe you should find another something else to be upset about.
Well, I think we all get upset about things that we perhaps shouldn't get upset about. I get a fair amount of email that corrects me over some of the most niggling points.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I do appreciate it when somebody points out when I made a serious mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I claimed that the Earth was flat. Or I didn't tell everyone that my guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, and she's the author of a number of books on the language. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's go now to Sarah from Atlantic Highlands. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I'm calling to speak to you. Thank you very much for your program. I always enjoy it. I'm calling because I'm increasingly vexed by people whom I feel misuse the subjunctive in English.
Mm-hmm.
And my example would be conditional phrases.
Mm-hmm.
When I was raised, you would say, if I had known you were going to the store, I would have asked you to buy a quart of milk.
Mm-hmm. That's not the subjunctive, by the way.
That's not the subjunctive?
Okay, no.
I thought that was, well, I guess in Spanish it's kind of more the part of the condition isn't the subjunctive.
Yeah.
But I
know.
Now people say, if I would mm-hmm. have known you were going to the store, I would have asked you to get a
right, right. They use. They overuse would.
Okay.
I get a lot of mail about that one, by the way.
Oh, good.
The idea is that you use if I had known, I would have gone.
Right.
Not if I would have known, I would have gone.
Right.
Right.
So, but why is it that seems to be more frequent all the time? Do you not experience that, or is it just?
I don't know. Old? I don't know that it's more frequent than it used to be. There's a phenomenon that linguists talk about, the recency phenomenon. You will once you start noticing something and becoming annoyed by it, you will think it's a recent thing. In fact, it may have been around earlier, and you just didn't notice it before.
Okay.
But no, I get a lot of mail, and people will say, all of a sudden, people are saying this, and I'll check into it and find that it's been rampant since the 40s or 50s.
Oh.
Well,
so
the 17th century in some cases.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I think it's just the recency phenomenon. Once something starts bothering you, you think it's new.
Okay. Well, I can certainly appreciate that might be the case. I just didn't know is that in fact incorrect? Am I correct in saying
you
that?
You are correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling us. We have a listener named Rachel who left a question on our show page. I'm curious about the use of the word pair when talking about one thing like a pair of pants. I understand a pair of socks because there are two socks,
mm-hmm.
but only one pants.
One pant?
We should say pant. Well, I guess, is it because it's really like two separate legs that we have attached together?
There are certain words that are plural in conception, I guess you'd say, but it's actually one item, and that includes tweezers, pliers, scissors, spectacles, pants. Did I say trousers?
Mm.
It's things that have a two-ness about them, but it's one thing. But you refer to it in the plural. Where are my trousers? Where are my pants? And as a result, I think you'll find marketers in clothing now tend to talk about a pant. Let me show you something in a taupe-colored pant to go with that sweater.
I would have thought that was something where somebody was going,
right. Or let me show you a nice crepe de chine trouser. Those words are legitimately plural, and you don't talk about a scissor or a tweezer. It's not the same thing as a pair of shoes where there are two separate. There's one shoe and then there's another shoe.
But to some degree, this just goes out of an
it's
older,
idiomatic, yeah. Right. Right, it's
and
idiomatic.
We accept that. We accept idioms.
True.
Another listener asks, why does English not have a formal second person plural, despite growing out of languages, French, Old English, which do?
Mm-hmm.
Y'all seems to be the closest thing we have.
Well, we used to have a second person plural. It was you. And the second person singular was ye.
Mm-hmm.
Ye and you were the singular and plural. Thee and thou were also singular and plural, but in the object position. I think I've got that right. Well, at any rate, we had four words for second person.
And we just simplified the whole thing?
Yes, we simplified them all and boiled them down to you. So now we have only one word where we used to have four.
And you sometimes just confuse.
It does. Like
when I say when you blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
The British would say when one
mm-hmm.
does
right.
that thing to distinguish itself from the confusing you that we
True.
Use in this country.
But I think they're
it sounds pretentious
well,
here
people
when
do.
We say when one goes
oh,
to
I
the
know.
Shop.
Yes. One does be alarmed, doesn't one, at that sort of thing.
But
anyway.
but if you say when you go to the store, the other person sometimes is confused. Are we talking about everybody
general,
or you in particular?
Right. And I think that lack of a second person plural is what has led to y'all in the South and yous in some parts of the Northeast. We seem to want to have another you to refer to all you guys and not just one of you.
My guess is Patricia T. O'Connor. Her books, the most recent, Origins of the Specious. There's Woe Is I. There's Words Fail Me. There's You Send Me. There's Woe Is I, Jr. The library just continues to grow. We will continue our conversation and take a lot more of your calls at 212-433-9692 right after this.
Oh, baby, what I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase.
We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor and Mel Torme, for that matter. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Did a listener ask you about the word husbandry recently?
Yes, and it's so interesting. I wanted to talk with that about that a little bit. The word husbandry, the listener said he assumed it once had something to do with husbands and marriage. Well, actually, no. Husbandry has nothing to do with marriage, at least not now. But it had nothing to do with marriage when it first entered English in the 13th century. The word husband, like the word wife, did not mean a married person when it first showed up in Old English. The noun husband originally meant a male head of household, and that could be someone who was married, widowed, single, whatever. It was irrelevant. But probably the wedded sense...
A house, would the word house be in that husb?
Yes, yes. Husbandi. The parts of it you have to do with old Icelandic and Old Norse, so it comes from Scandinavian. But probably the sense of a husband as a person who was wedded was derived from the fact that most male heads of household were married.
Well, we have the word midwife, and that has nothing to do
true.
With being married either.
True. The word wife or wif originally just meant a woman. It took 150, 200 years before it meant a married woman, a married adult female, and it took about 300 years for husband to mean a married man. And about that same time, around the year 1290 or so, husbandry entered the language as a noun for the management of a household and its resources. And husbandry later widened to mean farming and agriculture in general, including the raising of livestock, poultry, and such. And we still have this sense of husbandry today. We still speak of animal husbandry as a branch of farm management. So that's how animal husbandry has nothing to do with being married.
Although I've met a fair number of women who've told me that they thought their husbands were animals. So, and that's a whole other matter.
Yes.
For a different kind of guest. Frank from Mamaroneck. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, you guys.
Hi.
What's up?
I would like to ask, why do the words unbelievable and incredible have positive connotations when they literally mean lacking believability and lacking credibility?
And we have another listener, Alex in New York, who left a message on our show page asking, why has the word fantastic become a positive word?
Those are good questions. I don't know. Fantastic used to just meant characterized by fantasy. And incredible, of course, not believable. And I can't remember.
We're constantly searching for superlatives. Don't you think
that's
the reason? In the same way that
people
will say it's really good as opposed to it's good, afraid that if they simply say it's good, you won't believe them.
Sure. But it's true. If we say something, it was incredible. How was the concert? It was incredible. You mean that in a positive way. If it were incredibly bad, you'd say incredibly bad. So it almost has to be modifying a negative word to have any negative meaning. But you're right. I can't account for that. I don't know.
Okay.
Why it's always positive.
Okay, thank you.
Good question.
And there was a time when I was young when slang had you saying, that's bad, meaning it's good.
Oh, sure. Right.
So we're always looking for other ways of saying something is out of the ordinary and special.
Uh-huh. And positive.
Okay. John from Paramus, you're on the air.
How are you doing?
We're doing well.
Yeah,
and you?
It's always great to talk to both of you. And now it's my bad, whatever that means. My son goes through, when he does something wrong, he goes, my bad.
But my bad means, am I bad?
Means, I guess I did something wrong. Well, they're shortening the language now to Twitterese or whatever it is. But I wanted to know, what's with this use of this word transparency now? I hear it all over the place, and I thought transparency was something you could see through. But now they're using it in politics and the legal sense and everything else like that. How did that come about?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that a lot of times with problematical situations in politics, the problem has to do with the fact that something is opaque or hidden or obscured or somehow obfuscated. You can't see through to the truth. And when you try to make something, when you call for transparency, you're calling for clarity or visibility or...
So that is the proper use of the word, then, how they use it.
I think so, but it's, you know...
Well, I thought maybe there's something they made, you know, it's something new that they made.
Well, I think it's a new use of the word, an adaptation of it. But like many other things, if it seems pretty neat at first, then it gets worn out. It gets shop-worn and, you know, don't believe it anymore.
But you're saying that the reason we've adopted is because it's the opposite of opaque, and that makes sense. If we want to know what's really going on, we want what we used to call the sunshine laws, and we also understood what they were all about.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that we were putting sunshine onto a meeting or whatever, but we wanted to know what was happening. I guess we could have called them the light bulb laws.
Right.
And now, of course, we would only use green light bulbs.
Well, I guess it was my bad. I didn't know.
Yeah, well, it's your mistake. Thank you so much for calling us. A listener asks about something we've talked about in the past, empathic and empathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Are they two separate words with different meanings, or are they pretty much the same word?
I think they're pretty – you know, I've answered this before, and I tend to forget what the answer is in between. Maybe it's just a function of – of age, I'm not sure, but I think they have basically the same meaning. Here, I'm looking them up right now. Okay. Empathic, of or related, characterized by empathy. Empathetic means empathic. So, right, they have the same meaning. Empathetic and empathic.
Although most people say empathetic, don't they?
I think empathic came first, and I think empathetic was developed on analogy with sympathetic.
Is this the same sort of thing as egoist and egotist?
No, those do have slightly different meanings, and don't ask me what they are. I think an egoist, it's a philosophical worldview. An egotist is like a narcissist. That's a personality thing.
We go next to Stephanie from Bayville. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Hi there. I actually am very curious why it's been okay for so long for people to use someone to refer to anyone, and yet, as they continue that sentence, these same people use a plural.
Use they,
words,
them, or their.
Someone knocked at the door. They must be here.
Actually, my husband and I just did a piece about that for the New York Times magazine. It was in late July, 26th or something like that, about the history of that usage. And believe it or not, at one time that was standard English, to use they as a neutral, sex-neutral, number-neutral pronoun. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty handy, actually. It was pretty darn handy until people started complaining about it. It had the same function almost as the you, which
but we've gone in opposite directions,
before,
you're
saying. Right. You, nobody argued against you developing from its former plural object to all-purpose second-person pronoun.
We have another word like that.
Obvious, though.
Yeah, well, I think there's something about when you use an indefinite pronoun like someone or everyone or everybody, somebody, there is, even though they're technically singular, there is a pluralness involved. You're talking about an overview of everybody, of lots of people. And I think there is a pluralness about it, and they developed as a natural, they, them, and their, as natural reference to those.
Another word along these lines is none. A number of listeners have complained that I use the word both as in the singular and the plural, something I discovered has been happening in the English language since the 14th century or so. But
way before then.
But they point out that it was, of course, it's no one becomes none.
Well, that's not really a fair etymology. The etymology of none, it's closer in meaning to not any, which can be both singular or plural. Not any of them, not any of it. So if you think of it as meaning not any, you'll be closer to being correct. Most of the time, it's plural.
We just had a call from Stephanie from Bayville. Stephanie in Brooklyn left a comment on our show page. She says, my teenage daughter and her friends have been using the word sketchy to mean illegitimate, scary, and I guess just plain bad, as in a sketchy neighborhood. I've always thought that the word sketchy meant vague or incomplete. When did this other usage become common?
I think this usage developed out of that, that something sketchy is necessarily incomplete or something that you don't know enough about. So there's something unknown about it that you can't account for. So sketchy has come to take on a negative meaning for that reason.
We go now to a man whose name I like very much. Leonard. Hi, Leonard. Leonard from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Nice to hear from you.
Did we call you, Leonard?
Oh, yeah, it's me. Hi. Hello?
What do you want to talk about?
I have been arguing about this with a friend of mine who says the phrase all of the sudden as opposed to all of a sudden. I was wondering if maybe there's some. What is the history of this phrase? And are both of these workable, usable?
No, actually, I did a blog entry about this. All of the sudden, about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's interesting because that was an archaic usage that was pretty common. Centuries ago, people would say all on the sudden, or all of the sudden he did something, and that fell away, and it developed into all of a sudden, and now. It's unusual to hear people say all of the sudden, but
this is a return to the original usage.
I know, and of course it's accidental. It's not that people are going back and reading Chaucer or something like that. So these things have a way of coming back to haunt us, as I've said before on the
well,
air.
Maybe,
a lot of these things they've happened in the past.
Well, maybe your friend is from Canterbury.
New Hampshire, same thing.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
And I'm glad you mentioned your blog because a lot of people send me emails when they should really be checking you out. You have a blog called grammarphobia.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about some of the questions that we discuss on the show. But also people will send you things that they should send to mailbox@grammarphobia.com.
Right, and I do try to answer everybody. It may take a while, so you have to be a little patient with me, but I do try to answer everybody. So feel free. Anything you want to say, just email me.
Now here's one that seems to continue to vex people, and it's from Lisa from Manhattan. Hi, Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi. I have arguments with people all the time about this. Because I think it involves the five senses. I feel bad or I feel badly. I would always say I feel badly. If I'm saying I feel bad, I'm sick.
Mm.
So you wouldn't say I smell bad unless you meant that you had an odor. You would say I smell badly or I do not smell well. You know, I have a sense of smell that's off or something. So, but it gets sticky with I feel bad and badly, and I wanted to know if there was a rule when using those words.
Yeah,
L-Y is adverbial, and
yeah.
It would, and we are modifying the verb there, aren't we?
But yes, the problem is you think you have to use an L-Y adverb to modify every verb. That's not true of verbs like feel, smell, appear, be, seem, and a number
good,
of others.
I feel goodly.
Appear. No, you use the adjective form with those. I feel bad. I feel good. I smell bad. I appear bad.
But can we
yeah,
we could still say badly. Can't we say badly?
I feel badly. No.
No.
No. If you say I feel badly, you would mean you're not good at feeling.
Mm. Right.
You wouldn't be talking about the same kind, the same verb as the feel that you intend to be talking about. So, and for the same reason, it's perfectly okay to say I feel good.
Otherwise, James Brown would have been singing I feel goodly, just like I knew you woodly.
Well, you can say I feel well, but when you say I feel well, you're talking about your health. If you say I feel good, you mean you're at your mood.
Now, you're going to be back on the show on September 16th, but I guarantee you there are an awful lot of people who want to check out certain language ideas with you before then. Correct me, because that always happens.
Right.
And a reminder that you can do all of that. Put a question to Pat directly. Email her at mailbox@grammarphobia. You have to spell grammar correctly. That's the big problem for some people. Grammarphobia.com. And Pat, I look forward to seeing you on September 16th.
Thank you.
And it's always a pleasure talking with you. We're finished with the dictionaries now.
Okay.
On Thursday's show, Nicholas Schmidl describes the two transformative years he spent living in Pakistan to guest host Julie Burstein. Then Margot Mifflin on the life of Olive Oatman, a woman who was raised as a Mojave Indian after having been taken from her family. Then artist Paula Nadelstern talks about her new quilting exhibit on view at the American Folk Art Museum, plus our latest underreported segments look at the human rights crisis in the Congo and how the social networking site Facebook is positioning itself to tighten its grip on all other forms of social media. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. And we had help today from Natalie Pano and Alex Conrad. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Tune in tomorrow.